still call it The 13 Tales, even though it's been published as Tales of Change and Desperation for half a century. Why is that? It's what a combination of fame and secrecy does. With real knowledge about her so scant, fragments of information like the story of the recalled first edition take on an importance beyond their weight. It has become part of her mythology. The mystery of the 13th tale. It gives people something to speculate about. There is a short silence. Then, directing his gaze vaguely into the middle distance, and speaking lightly, so that I could pick up his words, or let them go, as I chose, he murmured, "And now a biography. How unexpected." I remembered the letter, my fear that its writer was not to be trusted. I remembered the insistence of the young man's words, "Tell me the truth." I remembered the 13 tales that took possession of me with its first words and held me captive all night. I wanted to be held hostage again. "I don't know what to do," I told my father.
"It is different from what you've done before. Vida Winter is a living subject. Interviews, instead of archives."
I nodded.
"But you want to know the person who wrote the 13 tales."
I nodded again. My father put his hands on his knees and sighed. "He knows what reading is, how it takes you."
"When does she want you to go?"
"Monday," I told him.
"I'll run you to the station, shall I?"
"Thank you. And..."
"Yes."
"Can I have some time off? I ought to do some more reading before I go up there."
"Yes,"
he said, with a smile that didn't hide his worry.
"Yes, of course."
There followed one of the most glorious times of my adult life. For the first time ever, I had on my bedside table a pile of brand-new, glossy paperbacks, purchased from a regular bookshop. Betwixt and Between by Vida Winter, Twice is Forever by Vida Winter, Hauntings by Vida Winter, Out of the Ark by Vida Winter, Rules of Affliction by Vida Winter, The Birthday Girl by Vida Winter, The Puppet Show by Vida Winter. The covers, all by the same artist, glowed with heat and power, amber and scarlet, gold and deep purple. I even bought a copy of Tales of Change and Desperation. Its title looked bare without the 13 that makes my father's copy so valuable. His own copy I had returned to the cabinet. Of course, one always hopes for something special when one reads an author one hasn't read before, and Miss Winter's books gave me the same thrill I had when I discovered the Landier diaries, for instance. But it was more than that. I've always been a reader. I've read at every stage of my life, and there has never been a time when reading was not my greatest joy. And yet I cannot pretend that the reading I have done in my adult years matches in its impact on my soul the reading I did as a child. I still believe in stories. I still forget myself when I'm in the middle of a good book. Yet it's not the same. Books are, for me, it must be said, the most important thing. What I cannot forget is that there was a time when they were at once more banal and more essential than that. When I was a child, books were everything. And so there is in me, always, a nostalgic yearning for the lost pleasure of books. It's not a yearning that one ever expects to be fulfilled. And during this time, these days, when I read all day and half the night, when I slept under a counterpane strewn with books, when my sleep was black and dreamless and passed in a flash and I woke to read again, the lost joys of reading returned to me. Miss Winter restored to me the virginal qualities of the novice reader, and then with her stories she ravished me. From time to time my father would knock at the door at the top of the stairs. He stared at me. I must have had that dazed look intense reading gives you. "You won't forget to eat, will you?" he said, as he handed me a bag of groceries or a pint of milk. I would have liked to stay in my flat forever with those books. But if I was to go to Yorkshire to meet Miss Winter, there was other work to be done. I took a day off from reading and went to the library. In the newspaper room, I looked at the books pages of the national newspapers for pieces on Miss Winter's recent novels. For every new book that came out, she summoned a number of journalists to a hotel in Harrogate, where she met them one by one and gave them separately what she termed her life story. There must have been dozens of these stories in existence. Hundreds, perhaps. I found almost 20 without looking very hard. After the publication of Betwixt and Between, she was the secret daughter of a priest and a schoolmistress. A year later, in the same newspaper, she got publicity for Hauntings by telling how she was the runaway child of a Parisian courtesan. For the puppet show, she was in various newspapers, an orphan raised in a Swiss convent, a street child from the back streets of the East End, and the stifled only girl in a family of 10 boisterous boys. I particularly liked the one in which, becoming accidentally separated in India from her Scottish missionary parents, she scraped out an existence for herself in the streets of Bombay, making a living as a storyteller. She told stories about pine trees that smelled like the freshest coriander, mountains as beautiful as the Taj Mahal, haggis more delicious than any street-corner pakora, and bagpipes. Oh, the sound of the bagpipes! So beautiful it defied description. When many years later she was able to return to Scotland, a country she had left as a tiny baby, she was gravely disappointed. The pine trees smelled nothing like coriander. Snow was cold. Haggis tasted flat. As for the bagpipes... Wry and sentimental, tragic and astringent, comic and sly, each and every one of these stories was a masterpiece in miniature. For a different kind of writer, they might be the pinnacle of her achievement. For Vida Winter, they were mere throwaways. No one, I think, would have mistaken them for the truth. The day before my departure was Sunday, and I spent the afternoon at my parents' house. It never changes. A single lupine exhalation would reduce it to rubble. My mother smiled a small, taut smile and talked brightly while we had tea. The neighbour's garden, the roadworks in town, a new perfume that had brought her up in a rash, light, empty chat, produced to keep silence at bay, silence in which her demons lived. It was a good performance. Nothing to reveal that she could hardly bear to leave the house, that the most minor, unexpected event gave her a migraine, that she could not read a book for fear of the feelings she might find in it. Father and I waited until Mother went to make fresh tea before talking about Miss Winter. "It's not her real name," I told him. "If it was her real name, it would be easy to trace her. And everyone who's tried is given up for want of information. No one knows even the simplest fact about her." How curious. It's as if she came from nowhere. As if, before being a writer, she didn't exist at all. As if she invented herself at the same time as her book. "We know what she chose for a pen name. That must reveal something, surely," my father suggested. "Vida. From Vita, Latin, meaning life. Though I can't help thinking of French, too. Vide, in French, means empty, the void, nothingness. But we don't use words like this in my parents' house, so I left it for him to infer." "Quite," he nodded. "And what about Winter?" "Winter." I looked out of the window for inspiration. Behind my sister's ghost, dark branches stretched naked across the darkening sky, and the flower beds were bare, black soil. The glass was no protection against the chill. Despite the gas fire, the room seemed filled with bleak despair. What did Winter mean to me? One thing only. Death. There was a silence. When it became necessary to say something so as not to burden the previous exchange with an intolerable weight, I said, "It's a spiky name. V and W. Vida, Winter. Very spiky." My mother came back, placing cups on saucers, pouring tea. She talked on, her voice moving as freely in her tightly policed plot of life as though it were 7 acres. My attention wandered. On the mantel over the fireplace was the one object in the room that might be considered decorative, a photograph. Every so often my mother talks about putting it away in a drawer, where it will be safe from dust. But my father likes to see it, and since he so rarely opposes her, on this she cedes to him. In the picture are a youthful bride and groom. Father looks the same as ever, quietly handsome, with dark, thoughtful eyes. The years don't change him. The woman is scarcely recognizable. A spontaneous smile, laughter in her eyes, warmth in her gaze as she looks at my father. She looks happy. Tragedy alters everything. I was born, and the woman in the wedding photo disappeared. I looked out into the dead garden. Against the fading light, my shadow hovered in the glass, looking into the dead room. What did she make of us, I wondered. What did she think of our attempts to persuade ourselves that this was life, and that we were really living it? Arrival. I left home on an ordinary winter day, and for miles my train ran under a gauzy white sky. Then I changed trains, and the clouds massed. They grew thicker and darker, more and more bloated, as I travelled north. At any moment I expected to hear the first scattering of drops on the windowpane. Yet the rain did not come. At Harrogate, Miss Winter's driver, a dark-haired, bearded man, was disinclined to talk. I was glad, for his lack of conversation left me free to study the unfamiliar views that unfolded as soon as we left the town behind. I'd never been north before. My researches had taken me to London, and once or twice across the Channel to libraries and archives in Paris. Yorkshire was a county I knew only from novels, and novels from another century at that. Once we left the town behind, there were few signs of the contemporary world, and it was possible to believe I was travelling into the past at the same time as into the countryside. The villages were quaint, with their churches and pubs and stone cottages. Then, the farther we went, the smaller the villages became, and the greater the distance between them, until isolated farmhouses were the only interruptions to the naked winter fields. At last, we left even the farmhouses behind, and it grew dark. The car's headlamps showed me swaths of a colourless, undefined landscape. No fences, no walls, no hedges, no buildings. Just a vergeless road, and each side of it vague undulations of darkness. "Is this the moors?" I asked.
"It is," the driver said.
And I leaned closer to the window, but all I could make out was the waterlogged sky that pressed down claustrophobically on the land, on the road, on the car. Beyond a certain distance, even the light from our headlamps was extinguished. At an unmarked junction, we turned off the road and bumped along for a couple of miles on a stony track. We stopped twice for the driver to open a gate and close it behind us. Then on we went, jolting and shaking, for another mile. Miss Winter's house lay between two slow rises in the darkness, almost hills that seemed to merge into each other, and that revealed the presence of a valley and a house only at the last turn of the drive. The sky by now was blooming shades of purple, indigo, and gunpowder, and the house beneath it crouched long and low and very dark. The driver opened the car door for me, and I stepped out to see that he had already unloaded my case and was ready to pull away, leaving me alone in front of an unlit porch. Barred shutters blacked out the windows, and there was not a single sign of human habitation. Closed in upon itself, the place seemed to shun visitors. I rang the bell. Its clang was oddly muted in the damp air. While I waited, I watched the sky. Cold crept through the soles of my shoes, and I rang the bell again. Still no one came to the door. About to ring for a third time, I was caught by surprise when, with no sound at all, the door was opened. The woman in the doorway smiled professionally and apologized for keeping me waiting. At first sight, she seemed very ordinary. Her short, neat hair was the same palish shade as her skin, and her eyes were neither blue nor grey nor green. Yet it was less the absence of colour than a lack of expression that made her plain. With some warmth of emotion in them, her eyes could, I suspected, have gleamed with life, and it seemed to me, as she matched my scrutiny glance for glance, that she maintained her inexpressivity only by deliberate effort. "Good evening," I said. "I'm Margaret Lee."
"The biographer. We've been expecting you."
What is it that allows human beings to see through each other's pretendings? For I understood quite clearly in that moment that she was anxious. Perhaps emotions have a smell or a taste. Perhaps we transmit them unknowingly by vibrations in the air. Whatever the means, I knew just as surely that it was nothing about me in particular that alarmed her, but only the fact that I had come and was a stranger. She ushered me in and closed the door behind me. The key turned in the lock without a sound, and there was not a squeak as the well-oiled bolts were slid noiselessly into place. Standing there in my coat in the hallway, I experienced for the first time the most profound oddity of the place. Miss Winter's house was entirely silent. The woman told me her name was Judith, and that she was the housekeeper. She asked about my journey and mentioned the hours of meals and the best times to get hot water. Her mouth opened and closed. As soon as her words fell from her lips, they were smothered by the blanket of silence that descended and extinguished them. The same silence swallowed our footfalls and muffled the opening and closing of doors as she showed me, one after another, the dining room, the drawing room, the music room. There was no magic behind the silence. It was the soft furnishings that did it. Overstuffed sofas were piled with velvet cushions. There were upholstered footstools, chaise longues and armchairs. Tapestries hung on the walls and were used as throws over upholstered furniture. Every floor was carpeted, every carpet overlaid with rugs. The damask that draped the windows also baffled the walls. Just as blotting paper absorbs ink, so all this wool and velvet absorbed sound, with one difference. Where blotting paper takes up only excess ink, the fabric of the house seemed to suck in the very essence of the words we spoke. I followed the housekeeper. We turned left and right, and right and left, went up and down stairs until I was thoroughly confused. I quickly lost all sense of how the convoluted interior of the house corresponded with its outer plainness. The house had been altered over time, I supposed, added to here and there. Probably we were in some wing or extension invisible from the front.
"You'll get the hang of it,"
the housekeeper mouthed, seeing my face, and I understood her as if I were lip-reading. Finally, we turned from a half-landing and came to a halt. She unlocked a door that opened into a sitting-room. There were three more doors leading off it. "Bathroom," she said, opening one of the doors. "Bedroom," opening another. "And study." The rooms were as padded with cushions and curtains and hangings as the rest of the house.
"Will you take your meals in the dining-room or here?"
she asked, indicating the small table and a single chair by the window. I didn't know whether meals in the dining room meant eating with my hostess, and unsure of my status in the house, was I a guest or an employee? I hesitated, wondering whether it was politer to accept or to refuse. Divining the cause of my uncertainty, the housekeeper added, as though having to overcome a habit of reticence,
"Miss Winter always eats alone."
"Then if it's all the same to you, I'll eat here."
"I'll bring you soup and sandwiches straight away, shall I? You must be hungry after the train. You've things to make your tea and coffee just here."
She opened a cupboard in the corner of the bedroom to reveal a kettle, the other paraphernalia for drinks making, and even a tiny fridge.
"It will save you from running up and down to the kitchen," she added,
and threw in an abashed smile by way of apology, I thought, for not wanting me in her kitchen. She left me to my unpacking. In the bedroom, it was the work of a minute to unpack my few clothes, my books, and my toiletries. I pushed the tea and coffee things to one side and replaced them with a packet of cocoa I had brought from home. Then I had just enough time to test the high antique bed. It was so lavishly covered with cushions that there could be any number of peas under the mattress and I wouldn't know it, before the housekeeper returned with a tray. "Miss Winter invites you to meet her in the library at 8 o'clock. She did her best to make it sound like an invitation, but I understood, as I was no doubt meant to, that it was a command. Meeting Miss Winter. Whether by luck or accident, I cannot say, but I found my way to the library a full 20 minutes earlier than I had been commanded to attend. It wasn't a problem. What better place to kill time than a library? And for me, what better way to get to know someone than through her choice and treatment of books? My first impression was of the room as a whole, and it struck me by its marked difference from the rest of the house. The other rooms were thick with the corpses of suffocated words. Here in the library you could breathe. Instead of being shrouded in fabric, it was a room made of wood. There were floorboards underfoot, shutters at the tall windows, and the walls were lined with solid oak shelves. It was a high room, much longer than it was wide. On one side, 5 arched windows reached from ceiling almost to floor. At their base, window seats had been installed. Facing them were 5 similarly shaped mirrors, positioned to reflect the view outside, but tonight echoing the carved panels of the shutters. The bookshelves extended from the walls into the rooms, forming bays. In each recess, an amber-shaded lamp was placed on a small table. Apart from the fire at the far end of the room, this was the only lighting, and it created soft, warm pools of illumination, at the edge of which rows of books melted into darkness. Slowly I made my way down the center of the room, taking a look into the bays on my right and left. After my first glances, I found myself nodding. It was a proper, well-maintained library, categorized, alphabetized, and clean. It was just as I would have done it myself. All my favorites were there, with a great number of rare and valuable volumes, as well as more ordinary, well-thumbed copies. Not only Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, The Woman in White, but The Castle of Otranto, Lady Audley's Secret, The Spectre Bride. I was thrilled to come across a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde so rare that my father had given up believing in its existence. Marvelling at the rich selection of volumes on Miss Winter's shelves, I browsed my way toward the fireplace at the far end of the room. In the final bay on the right, one particular set of shelves stood out even from some distance. Instead of displaying the mellow, predominantly brown stripes that were the spines of the older books, this stack showed the silvery blues, sage greens, and pink beiges of more recent decades. They were the only modern books in the room. Miss Winter's own works. With her earliest titles at the top of the stack, and recent novels at the bottom, each work was represented in its many different editions, and even in different languages. I saw no 13 Tales, the mistitled book I had read at the bookshop. But in its other guise, as Tales of Change and Desperation, there were more than 12 different editions. I selected a copy of Miss Winter's most recent book. On page 1, an elderly nun arrives at a small house in the back streets of an unnamed town that seems to be in Italy. She is shown into a room where a pompous young man, whom we take to be English or American, greets her in some surprise. I turned the page. The first paragraphs had drawn me in, just as I had been drawn in every time I had opened one of her books, and without meaning to, I began to read in earnest. The young man does not at first appreciate what the reader already understands, that his visitor has come on a grave mission, one that will alter his life in ways he cannot be expected to foresee. She begins her explanation and bears it patiently. I turned the page. I had forgotten the library, forgotten Miss Winter, forgotten myself. When he treats her with the levity of indulged youth. And then something penetrated through my reading and drew me out of the book. A prickling sensation at the back of the neck. Someone was watching me. I know the back-of-the-neck experience is not an uncommon phenomenon. It was, however, the first time it had happened to me. Like those of a great many solitary people, my senses are acutely attuned to the presence of others, and I'm more used to being the invisible spy in a room than to being spied upon. Now someone was watching me, and not only that, but whoever it was had been watching me for some time. How long had that unmistakable sensation been tickling me? I thought back over the past minutes, trying to retrace the memory of the body behind my memory of the book. Was it since the nun began to speak to the young man? Since she was shown into the house? Or earlier? Without moving a muscle, head bent over the page as though I had noticed nothing, I tried to remember. Then I realized. I had felt it even before I'd picked up the book. Needing a moment to recover myself, I turned to the page, continuing the pretense of reading.
You can't fool me.
Imperious, declamatory, magisterial. There was nothing to be done but turn and face her. Vida Winter's appearance was not calculated for concealment. She was an ancient queen, sorceress or goddess. Her stiff figure rose regally out of a profusion of fat purple and red cushions. Draped around her shoulders, the folds of the turquoise and green cloth that cloaked her body did not soften the rigidity of her frame. Her bright, copper hair had been arranged into an elaborate confection of twists, curls, and coils. Her face, as intricately lined as a map, was powdered white and finished with bold, scarlet lipstick. In her lap, her hands were a cluster of rubies, emeralds, and white bony knuckles. Only her nails, unvarnished, cut short and square like my own, struck an incongruous note. What unnerved me more than all the rest were her sunglasses. I couldn't see her eyes, but as I remembered the inhuman green irises from the poster, her dark lenses seemed to develop the force of a searchlight. I had the impression that from behind them she was looking through my skin and into my very soul. I drew a veil over myself, masked myself in neutrality, hid behind my appearance. For an instant, I think she was surprised that I was not transparent, that she couldn't see straight through me. But she recovered quickly, more quickly than I had.
"Very well," she said tartly. And her smile was for herself more than for me. To business. Your letter gives me to understand that you have reservations about the commission I am offering you.
Well, yes, that is... The voice ran on as if it had not registered the interruption.
I could suggest increasing the monthly stipend and the final fee.
I licked my lips, sought the right words. Before I could speak... Miss Winter's dark shades had bobbed up and down, taking in my flat brown bangs, my straight skirt and navy cardigan. She smiled a small, pitying smile, and overrode my intention to speak.
But pecuniary interest is clearly not in your nature. How quaint.
Her tone was dry.
I have written about people who don't care for money, but I never expected to meet one.
She leaned back against the cushions.
Therefore, I conclude that the difficulty concerns integrity. People whose lives are not balanced by a healthy love of money suffer from an appalling obsession with personal integrity.
She waved a hand, dismissing my words before they were out of my mouth.
You are afraid of undertaking an authorized biography in case your independence is compromised. You suspect that I want to exert control over the content of the finished book. You know that I have resisted biographies in the past and are wondering what my agenda is in changing my mind now. Above all, the dark gaze of her sunglasses again. You are afraid I mean to lie to you. I opened my mouth to protest, but found nothing to say. She was right. You see, you don't know what to say, do you? Are you embarrassed to accuse me of wanting to lie to you? People don't like to accuse each other of lying. And for heaven's sake, sit down. I sat down. I don't accuse you of anything, I began mildly, but immediately she interrupted me. Don't be so polite. If there's one thing I can't abide, it's politeness. Her forehead twitched, and an eyebrow rose over the top of the sunglasses. A strong black arch that bore no relation to any natural brow. Politeness. Now there's a poor man's virtue, if ever there was one. What's so admirable about inoffensiveness, I should like to know. After all, it's easily achieved. One needs no particular talent to be polite. On the contrary, being nice is what's left when you've failed at everything else. People with ambition don't give a damn what other people think about them. I hardly suppose Wagner lost sleep worrying whether he'd hurt someone's feelings. But then he was a genius. Her voice flowed relentlessly on, recalling instance after instance of genius and its bedfellow selfishness, and the folds of her shawl never moved as she spoke. She must be made of steel, I thought. Eventually she drew her lecture to a close with the words, "Politeness is a virtue I neither possess nor esteem in others. We need not concern ourselves with it." And with the air of having had the final word on the subject, she stopped. "You raised the topic of lying," I said. "That is something we might concern ourselves with." "In what respect?" Through the dark lenses I could just see the movements of Miss Winter's lashes. They crouched and quivered around the eye, like the long legs of a spider around its body. "You have given 19 different versions of your life story to journalists in the last 2 years alone. That's just the ones I found on a quick search. There are many more, hundreds, probably." She shrugged. "It's my profession. I'm a storyteller." "I am a biographer. I work with facts." She tossed her head and her stiff curls moved as one. "How horribly dull. I could never have been a biographer. Don't you think one can tell the truth much better with a story?"
"Not in the stories you've told the world so far."
Miss Winter conceded a nod. "Miss Lee," she began. Her voice was slower. "I had my reasons for creating a smokescreen around my past. Those reasons, I assure you, are no longer valid."
"What reasons?"
"Life is compost."
I blinked.
"You think that's a strange thing to say, but it's true. All my life, and all my experience, the events that have befallen me, the people I have known, all my memories, dreams, fantasies, everything I've ever read, all of that has been chucked onto the compost heap, where over time it is rotted down to a dark, rich, organic mulch. The process of cellular breakdown makes it unrecognizable. Other people call it the imagination. I think of it as a compost heap. Every so often I take an idea, plant it in the compost, and wait. It feeds on that black stuff that used to be a life, takes its energy for its own. It germinates, takes root, produces shoots, and so on and so forth until one fine day I have a story. Or a novel."
I nodded, liking the analogy.
"Readers," continued Miss Winter, "are fools. They believe all writing is autobiographical. And so it is, but not in the way they think. The writer's life needs time to rot away before it can be used to nourish a work of fiction. It must be allowed to decay." That's why I couldn't have journalists and biographers rummaging around in my past, retrieving bits and pieces of it, preserving it in their words. To write my books, I needed my past left in peace, for time to do its work. I considered her answer, then asked, "And what has happened to change things now?" "I'm old. I'm ill." "Put those two facts together, biographer, and what do you get?" "The end of the story, I think." I bit my lip. "And why not write the book yourself?" "I've left it too late. Besides, who would believe me? I've cried wolf too often."
"Do you intend to tell me the truth?" I asked.
"Yes," she said. But I had heard the hesitation, even though it lasted only a fraction of a second. "And why do you want to tell it to me?" She paused. "Do you know, I've been asking myself the very same question for the last quarter of an hour. Just what kind of a person are you, Miss Lee?" I fixed my mask in place before replying. "I'm a shop assistant. I work in an antiquarian bookshop. I am an amateur biographer. Presumably you've read my work on the Landier brothers."
"It's not much to go on, is it? If we are to work together, I shall need to know a little more about who you are. I can hardly spill the secrets of a lifetime to a person of whom I know nothing. So tell me about yourself. What are your favourite books? What do you dream about? Whom do you love?"
On the instant, I was too affronted to reply.
"Well, answer me, for goodness sake. Am I to have a stranger living under my roof? A stranger working for me? It's not reasonable. Tell me this. Do you believe in ghosts?"
Governed by something stronger than reason, I rose from my chair.
"Whatever are you doing? Where are you going? Wait!"
I took one step after another, trying not to run, conscious of the rhythm of my feet rapping out on the wooden boards, while she called to me in a voice that contained an edge of panic.
"Come back," she cried. "I'm going to tell you a story, a marvellous story."
I didn't stop.
"Once upon a time there was a haunted house."
I reached the door, my fingers closed on the handle.
"Once upon a time there was a library."
I opened the door and was about to step into its emptiness, when in a voice hoarse with something like fear, she launched the words that stopped me in my tracks.
"Once upon a time, there were twins."
I waited until the words stopped their ringing in the air, and then, despite myself, I looked back. I saw the back of her head, and hands that rose, trembling, to the averted face. Tentatively, I took a step back into the room. At the sound of my feet, the copper curls turned. I was stunned. The glasses were gone. Green eyes, bright as glass and as real, looked to me with something like a plea. For a moment I simply stared back. Then,
"Miss Lee, won't you please sit down?"
said a voice shakily, a voice that was and was not Vida Winters. Drawn by something beyond my control, I moved toward the chair and sat down. "I'm not making any promises," I said wearily.
"I'm not in a position to exact any,"
came the answer in a small voice.
"Truce."
"Why did you choose me?" I asked again, and this time she answered.
"Because of your work on the Landier brothers. Because you know about siblings."
"And will you tell me the truth?"
"I will tell you the truth."
The words were unambiguous enough, but I heard the tremor that undermined them. She meant to tell me the truth. I didn't doubt it. She had decided to tell. Perhaps she even wanted to tell. Only she didn't quite believe that she would. Her promise of honesty was spoken as much to convince herself as to persuade me.
and she heard the lack of conviction at its heart as clearly as I did. And so I made a suggestion. I will ask you three things, things that are a matter of public record. When I leave here, I will be able to check what you tell me. If I find you have told me the truth about them, I will accept the commission.
Ah, the rule of three, the magic number. Three trials before the prince wins the hand of the fair princess, three wishes granted to the fisherman by the magic talking fish, three bears for Goldilocks, and three billy goats Gruff. Miss Lee, if you had asked me two questions, or four, I might have been able to lie. But three.
I slid my pencil from the ring binding of my pad and opened the cover. What is your real name? She swallowed.
Are you quite sure this is the best way to proceed? I could tell you a ghost story, a rather good one, even if I do say so myself. It might be a better way of getting to the heart of things.
I shook my head. Tell me your name. The jumble of knuckles and rubies shifted in her lap. The stones glowed in the firelight.
My name is Vida Winter. I went through the necessary legal procedures in order to be able to call myself by that name legally and honestly. What you want to know is the name by which I was known prior to the change. That name was...
She paused, needing to overcome some obstacle within herself. And when she pronounced the name, it was with a noticeable neutrality, an utter absence of intonation, as though it were a word in some foreign language she had never applied herself to learning.
That name was Adeline March.
As though to cut short even the minimal vibration the name carried in the air, she continued rather tartly,
I hope you're not going to ask my date of birth. I am of an age when it is de rigueur to have forgotten it.
I can manage without, if you give me your place of birth. She released an irritated sigh.
I could tell you much better if you would only allow me to tell it my way.
This is what we've agreed. Three facts, on public record. She pursed her lips.
You will find it is a matter of record that Adeline March was born in St. Bartholomew's Hospital, London. I can hardly be expected to offer any personal guarantee of the veracity of that detail. Though I am an exceptional person, I am not so exceptional that I can remember my own birth.
I noted it down. Now the third question. I had, it must be admitted, no particular third question prepared. She didn't want to tell me her age, and I hardly needed her date of birth. With her long publishing history and the date of her first book, she couldn't be less than 73 or 74, and to judge by her appearance, altered though it was by illness and make-up, she couldn't be more than 80. But the uncertainty didn't matter. With her name and her place of birth, I could find the date out for myself anyway. From my first two questions, I already had the information I needed in order to ascertain that a person by the name of Adeline March actually existed. What to ask, then? Perhaps it was my desire to hear Miss Winter tell a story. But when the occasion arose to play my third question as a wild card, I seized it. Tell me, I began slowly, carefully. In the stories with the wizards, it is always with the third wish that everything so dangerously won is disastrously snatched away. Tell me something that happened to you in the days before you changed your name, for which there exists a public record. Educational successes, I was thinking, school sporting achievements, those minor triumphs that are recorded for proud parents and for posterity. In the hush that followed, Miss Winter seemed to draw all of her external self into her core. Under my very eyes, she managed to absent herself from herself. And I began to understand how it was that earlier I had failed to see her. I watched the shell of her, marvelled at the impossibility of knowing what was going on beneath the surface. And then she emerged.
Do you know why my books are so successful?
For a great many reasons, I believe.
Possibly. Largely, it is because they have a beginning, a middle, and an end. In the right order. Of course, all stories have beginnings, middles, and endings. It is having them in the right order that matters. That is why people like my books. She sighed and fidgeted with her hands. I'm going to answer your question. I'm going to tell you something about myself which happened before I became a writer and changed my name, and it is something for which there exists a public record. It is the most important thing that has ever happened to me, but I didn't expect to find myself telling it to you so soon. I shall have to break one of my rules to do it. I shall have to tell you the end of my story before I tell you the beginning.
The end of your story? How can that be if it happened before you started writing?
Quite simply because my story, my own personal story, ended before my writing began. Storytelling has only ever been a way of filling in the time since everything finished.
I waited, and she drew in her breath like a chess player who finds his key piece cornered.
I would sooner not tell you. But I have promised, haven't I? Rule of three. It's unavoidable. The wizard might beg the boy not to make a third wish because he knows it will end in disaster, but the boy will make a third wish, and the wizard is bound to grant it because it is in the rules of the story. You asked me to tell you the truth about three things, and I must, because of the rule of three. But let me first ask you something in return.
What?
After this, no more jumping about in the story. From tomorrow, I will tell you my story, beginning at the beginning, continuing with the middle, and with the end at the end. Everything in its proper place. No cheating, no looking ahead, no questions, no sneaky glances at the last page.
Did she have the right to place conditions on our deal, having already accepted it?
Not really.
Still, I nodded.
I agree. She couldn't quite look at me as she spoke. I lived at Angelfield.
Her voice trembled over the place name, and she scratched nervously at her palm in an unconscious gesture.
I was 16.
Her voice grew stilted. Fluency deserted her.
There was a fire.
The words were expelled from her throat, hard and dry, like stones.
I lost everything.
And then the cry breaking from her lips before she could stop it.
Oh, Emmeline.
There are cultures in which it is believed that a name contains all a person's mystical power, that a name should be known only to God and to the person who holds it, and to very few privileged others. To pronounce such a name, either one's own or someone else's, is to invite jeopardy. This, it seemed, was such a name. Miss Winter pressed her lips together, too late. A tremor ran through the muscles under the skin. Now I knew I was tied to the story. I had stumbled upon the heart of the tale that I had been commissioned to tell. It was love and loss. For what else could the sorrow of that exclamation be but bereavement? In a flash I saw beyond the mask of white makeup and the exotic draperies. For a few seconds it seemed to me that I could see right into Miss Winter's heart, right into her thoughts. I recognized the very essence of her. How could I fail to? For was it not the essence of me? We were both lone twins. With this realization, the leash of the story tightened around my wrists, and my excitement was suddenly cut through with fear. "Where can I find a public record of this fire?" I asked, trying not to let my perturbed feelings show in my voice.
"The local newspaper. The Banbury Herald.
I nodded, made a note in my pad, and flipped the cover closed. Although, she added,
there is a record of a different kind that I can show you now.
I raised an eyebrow.
Come nearer.
I rose from my chair and took a step, halving the distance between us. Slowly she raised her right arm and held out to me a closed fist that seemed three-quarters precious stones in their claw-like settings. In a movement that spoke of great effort, she turned her hand and opened it, as though she had some surprise gift concealed and was about to offer it to me. But there was no gift. The surprise was the hand itself. The flesh of her palm was like no flesh I had seen before. Its whitened ridges and purple furrows bore no relation to the pink mound at the base of my fingers, the pale valley of my palm. Melted by fire, her flesh had cooled into an entirely unrecognizable landscape, like a scene left permanently altered by the passage of a flow of lava. Her fingers did not lie open, but were drawn into a claw by the shrunken tightness of the scar tissue. In the heart of her palm, scar within a scar, burn inside burn, was a grotesque mark. It was set very deep in her clutch, so deep that with a sudden nausea I wondered what had happened to the bone that should be there. It made sense of the odd set of the hand at the wrist, the way it seemed to weigh upon her arm as though it had no life of its own. The mark was a circle embedded in her palm, and extending from it, in the direction of the thumb, a short line. Thinking about it now, I realized that the mark had more or less the form of a Q. But at the time, in the shock of this unexpected and painful act of revealment, it had no such clarity, and it disturbed me the way I would be disturbed by the appearance on a page of English of an unfamiliar symbol from a lost and unreadable language. A sudden vertigo took hold of me, and I reached behind me for my chair.
"I'm sorry," I heard her say. "One gets so used to one's own horrors, one forgets how they must seem to other people."
I sat down, and gradually the blackness at the edge of my vision receded. Miss Winter closed her fingers into her damaged palm, swiveled her wrist, and drew the jewel-encrusted fist back into her lap. In a protective gesture, she curled the fingers of her other hand around it.
"I'm sorry you didn't want to hear my ghost story, Miss Lee."
"I'll hear it another time." Our interview was over. On my way back to my quarters, I thought of the letter she had sent me, the strained and painstaking hand that I had never seen the like of before. I'd put it down to illness, arthritis, perhaps. Now I understood. From the very first book, and through her entire career, Miss Winter had written her masterpieces with her left hand. In my study, the velvet curtains were green, and a pale gold watermark satin covered the walls. Despite the woolly hush, I was pleased with the room, for the overall effect was relieved by the broad wooden desk and the plain upright chair that stood under the window. I switched on the desk lamp and laid out the ream of paper I had brought with me and my 12 pencils. They were brand new, unsharpened columns of red, just what I like to start a new project with. The last thing I took from my bag was my pencil sharpener. I screwed it like a vise to the edge of the desk and set the paper basket directly underneath. On impulse, I climbed onto the desk and reached behind the elaborate valance to the curtain pole. My fingers groped for the tops of the curtains, and I felt for the hooks and stitches that attached them. It was hardly a job for one person. The curtains were floor-length, lined and interlined, and their weight flung over my shoulder was crushing. But after a few minutes, first one, then the other curtain was folded and in a cupboard. I stood in the center of the floor and surveyed the result of my work. The window was a large expanse of dark glass, and in the center of it, my ghost, darkly transparent, was staring in at me. Her world was not unlike my own. The pale outline of a desk on the other side of the glass, and farther back a deeply buttoned armchair placed inside the circle of light cast by a standard lamp. But where my chair was red, hers was grey. And where my chair stood on an Indian rug surrounded by light gold walls, her chair hovered spectrally in an undefined, endless plane of darkness in which vague forms, like waves, seemed to shift and breathe. Together we began the little ritual of preparing our desks. We divided a ream of paper into smaller piles and flicked through each one to let the air in. One by one, we sharpened our pencils, turning the handle and watching the long shavings curl and dangle their way to the paper bin below. When the last pencil had been shaved to a fine point, we did not put it down with the others, but kept hold of it. "There," I said to her, "ready for work." She opened her mouth, seemed to speak to me. I couldn't hear what she was saying. I have no shorthand. During the interview, I had simply jotted down lists of keywords, and my hope was that if I wrote up our interviews immediately afterward, these words would be enough to jog my memory. And from that first meeting, it worked well. Glancing at my notebook from time to time, I filled the center of my sheets of foolscap with Miss Winter's words, conjuring her image in my mind, hearing her voice, seeing her mannerisms. Soon I was hardly aware of my notebook, but was taking dictation from the Miss Winter in my head. I left wide margins. In the left-hand one, I noted any mannerisms, expressions, and gestures that seemed to add something to her meaning. The right-hand margin I left blank. Later, rereading, it was here that I would enter my own thoughts, comments, questions. I felt as though I had worked for hours. I emerged to make myself a cup of cocoa, but it was time suspended and did not disturb the flow of my recreation. I returned to my work and picked up the thread as though there had been no interruption. "One gets so used to one's own horrors, one forgets how they must seem to other people," I wrote at last in the middle column. And in the left I added a note describing the way she closed the fingers of her good hand over the closed fist of the damaged one. I drew a double line under the last line of script, and stretched. In the window, the other me stretched as well. She took the pencils whose points she had worn and sharpened them one by one. She was mid-yawn when something began to happen to her face. First, it was a sudden blurring in the center of her forehead, like a blister. Another mark appeared on her cheek, then beneath her eye, on her nose, on her lips. Each new blemish was accompanied by a dull thud, a percussion that grew faster and faster. In a few seconds, her entire face, it seemed, had decomposed. But it was not the work of death. It was only rain. The long-awaited rain. I opened the window, let my hand be drenched, then wiped the water over my eyes and face. I shivered. Time for bed. I left the window ajar so that I could listen to the rain as it continued to fall with an even, muffled softness. I heard it while I was undressing, while I was reading, and while I slept. It accompanied my dreams like a poorly tuned radio left on through the night, broadcasting a fuzzy white noise, beneath which were the barely audible whispers of foreign languages and snatches of unfamiliar tunes. And so we began. At 9 o'clock the next morning, Miss Winter sent for me and I went to her in the library. By daylight, the room was quite different. With the shutters folded back, the full-height windows let the light flood in from the pale sky. The garden, still wet from the night's downpour, gleamed in the morning sun. The exotic plants by the window seats seemed to touch leaf with their hardier, damper cousins beyond the glass, and the delicate framework that held the panes in place seemed no more solid than the glimmering threads of a spider's web stretched across a garden path from branch to branch. The library itself, slighter, narrower seemingly than the night before, appeared as a mirage of books in the wet winter garden. In contrast to the paly blue sky and the milk-white sun, Miss Winter was all heat and fire, an exotic hothouse flower in a northern winter garden. She wore no sunglasses today, but her eyelids were coloured purple, lined Cleopatra-style with kohl and fringed with the same heavy black lashes as yesterday. In the clear daylight, I saw what I had not seen the night before. Along the ruler-straight parting in Miss Winter's copper curls was a narrow margin of pure white. "You remember our agreement," she began, as I sat down in the chair on the other side of the fire. "Beginnings, middles, and endings, all in the correct order. No cheating, no looking ahead, no questions." I was tired. A strange bed in a strange place, and I had woken with a dull, atonic tune ringing in my head. "Start where you like," I said. "I shall start at the beginning. Though, of course, the beginning is never where you think it is. Our lives are so important to us that we tend to think the story of them begins with our birth. First, there was nothing. Then I was born. Yet that's not so. Human lives are not pieces of string that can be separated out from a knot of others and laid out straight. Families are webs. Impossible to touch one part of it without setting the rest vibrating. Impossible to understand one part without having a sense of the whole. My story is not only mine. It is the story of Angelfield. Angelfield the village. Angelfield the house. And the Angelfield family itself. George and Mathilde. Their children. Charlie and Isabel. Isabel's children. Emmeline and Adeline. Their house. Their fortunes. Their fears. And their ghost. One should always pay attention to ghosts, shouldn't one, Miss Lee? She gave me a sharp look. I pretended not to see it. A birth is not really a beginning. Our lives at the start are not really our own, but only the continuation of someone else's story. Take me, for instance. To look at me now, you would think my birth must have been something special, wouldn't you? Accompanied by strange portents, and attended by witches and fairy godmothers. But no, not a bit of it. In fact, when I was born, I was no more than a subplot. But how do I know this story that precedes my birth, I hear you thinking? What are the sources? Where does the information come from? Well, where does any information come from in a house like Angelfield? The servants, of course. The missus, in particular. Not that I learned it all directly from her lips. Sometimes, it is true, she would reminisce about the past while she sat cleaning the silverware, and seemed to forget my presence as she spoke. She frowned as she remembered village rumours and local gossip. Events and conversations and scenes rose to her lips and played themselves out afresh over the kitchen table. But sooner or later, the story would lead her into areas unsuitable for a child, unsuitable in particular for me. Then suddenly she would remember I was there, break off her account mid-sentence and start rubbing the cutlery vigorously, as if to erase the past altogether. But there can be no secrets in a house where there are children. I pieced the story together another way. When the missus talked with the gardener over their morning tea, I learned to interpret the sudden silences that punctuated seemingly innocent conversations. Without appearing to notice anything, I saw the silent glances that certain words provoked between them. And when they thought they were alone and could talk privately, they were not, in fact, alone. In this way, I understood the story of my origins. And later, when the missus was no longer the woman she used to be, when age confused her and released her tongue, then her meanderings confirmed the story I'd spent years divining. It is this story, the one that came to me in hints, glances, and silences, I am going to translate into words for you now. Miss Winter cleared her throat, preparing to start. Isabel Angelfield was odd. Her voice seemed to slip away from her, and she stopped, surprised. When she spoke again, her tone was cautious.
"Isabel Angelfield was born during a rainstorm."
It came again, the abrupt loss of voice. So used was she to hiding the truth that it had become atrophied in her. She made one false start, then another. But like a gifted musician who, after years without playing, takes up her instrument again, she finally found her way. She told me the story of Isabel and Charlie.
Isabel Angelfield was odd. Isabel Angelfield was born during a rainstorm. It is impossible to know whether or not these facts are connected. But when 2.5 decades later, Isabel left home for the second time, people in the village looked back and remembered the endlessness of the rain on the day of her birth. Some remembered as if it was yesterday that the doctor was late, delayed by the floods caused by the river having burst its banks. Others recalled beyond the shadow of a doubt that the cord had been wrapped round the baby's neck, almost strangling her before she could be born. Yes, it was a difficult birth, all right. For on the stroke of 6, just as the baby was born and the doctor rang the bell, hadn't the mother passed away, out of this world and into the next? So if the weather had been fine, and the doctor had been earlier, and if the cord had not deprived the child of oxygen, and if the mother had not died, and if... Such thinking is pointless. Isabel was as Isabel was, and that is all there is to say about the matter. The infant, a white scrap of fury, was motherless. And at the beginning, to all intents and purposes, it looked like she'd been fatherless too. For her father,